From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Reagan Edelman. The phenomenon of the Bradley effect, sometimes known as the social desirability bias, originated in 1982 when a black mayor named Tom Bradley ran for governor of California. On the eve of the election, polls anointed him an easy favorite. But on election day, Bradley lost to his white opponent. Political analysts were concerned about the Bradley effect in 2008 in regards to Obama, and now it's really time to think about how this may impact Kamala Harris. In his new book, Breaking Bias, Anu Gupta works to build a framework on how to dismantle both our personal and systemic biases, and he suggests that the Bradley effect may cost Harris the election if we don't follow this framework to relearn our biases. Anu Gupta is a lawyer, a scientist, and an educator focused on combining neuroscience, psychology, and research to find the causes of and solutions to organizational diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. His most recent book is Breaking Bias. Anu Gupta, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the Bradley effect and the role it has in our upcoming election, I want to talk a little bit about bias as a whole. You graduated from Cambridge before you sought your law degree, and you shifted from focusing on biology and chemistry to more humanities-based social sciences. And this draw was partially based on a pretty heart-wrenching story that you opened the book with, of how you were treated when you moved to the United States and how blatantly the biases of bullies were thrown at you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my journey was, as a lot of immigrants and people from any marginalized communities experience, was one of a lot of misunderstanding. You know, people saw me as someone different. And as a result, they went back to their conditioning around how they perceived people like me. And as a result, bullied me, right? Calling me anything from a terrorist to, you know, bullying around my sexuality. And I just internalized those ideas as, oh, they're just, you know, saying that I'll just swallow and forget about it. But it was when I came back to the US to go to law school, you know, the continuous kind of gaslighting I experienced because of how I was treated because I was different lit kind of a match of self-hatred in me that I'd suppressed for 23 years at that time. So I found myself on the ledge of my 18th floor window about to jump off because I had believed and internalized a lot of the lies about my sexuality as a queer man, my ethnicity as someone of Asian Indian descent, my religious background as being very interspiritual between Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism. And these were the lies that led me to that ledge. And what happened was instead of falling forward, I fell backward into my apartment. And for me, that's really the moment of grace that I have no explanation for other than it put me on my own breaking bias journey. And what I discovered on this journey, you know, through the neuroscience, the social psychology, and all the things I really talk about in this book were incredibly transformative for my own sense of being and how I saw myself and perceived myself, but also how we can address some of the most intractable problems in our society that are rooted in this, you know, this phenomenon we call bias. So the way I define bias and the way scientists really define bias is that it's a learned habit. And it's a learned habit that distorts how we perceive, reason, remember, and make decisions toward ourselves and toward others.
And you suggest that there are a few ways that we are essentially trained to have those biases through culture, social contact, education, and the media, right?
Exactly. So there are five causes that, you know, I wanted to identify. Well, how do we learn these biases if they're learned? And there are just five causes around the world for any form of bias. And the good news for me is that just as biases are learned, they can be unlearned.
So let's talk about those ways that we're trained to have biases. The first one is culturally.
One thing I want to say is that there are two forms of biases, you know, because people often confuse the two, and it's really important for us to discern the difference. So there's conscious bias, which are learned false beliefs, and then there are unconscious biases, which are learned habits of thoughts. So those are just associations that arise because we've been trained subliminally around associating a person's color or gender or identity, other identities, with a concept. What are the first associations that come to mind? So with that said, well, how do we learn these biases? Well, there are five causes. The first cause of any form of bias, whether it's race or gender or age or disability, is a story. And it's generally a false story about their humanity. So that's where it all starts. And then the second cause is really the policies that are enacted based on that flawed story. So if you think about policies that were enacted in our nation around race or gender, right? Because people believed that certain groups of people, because of their race, were inferior, they were kept in separate locations. They couldn't vote. They couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. They couldn't attend certain universities. Same thing for women or other marginalized groups. So those stories and policies really interplay together to build the infrastructure of how bias is learned. And then individually, as all of us humans, are then neurologically trained in these biases through those three vectors of culture: social contact, which is really our trusted sources of, you know, influence, our friends, our family members, our pastors, our rabbis, and what they believe. The second is education. So oftentimes in education, we're given misinformation about who we are as human beings, or there are information gaps around our various human identities. So we never learn it. And the third is media. And media is probably one of the most powerful ways that we learn unconscious biases because of those associations that we see with visual images of humans.
You talk a little bit about patriarchy and the four phases of gender hierarchy in the book. And you mentioned that for most of human history, human cultures and societies were engaged in these social experiments. And one of those was patriarchy.
When I started writing the book, I wanted to talk about it from the lens of humanity, because one of the things I discovered pretty early on my breaking bias journey is that the Human Genome Project actually identified that every human being across the world is 99.9% identical genetically, biologically. We're part of the same species. And then a lot of research and archaeology and biogenetics have shown that, you know, for folks like you and I, if we go 500 years back, we had 15 million ancestors who produced the one person we are today. 15 million, that's a lot of people, right? Each one of us are basically a continuation of those 15 million people. And all of those people were likely, they looked different, they were of different sexualities, genders, you name it, right? From across the world. And that's why there's an article in National Geographic that shows that every human being alive is a relative of one another in some shape or form. So these are really promising and optimistic observations that scientists have made. But because of the conditioning of bias, we forget them. And that's what I wanted to really uncover is like, well, where does gender bias come from? How is it that women across various societies have been subordinated? And not just women, but also, you know, people with, you know, non-binary gender identities or gender identities outside of the binary. What has happened? And I really discovered that, what we understand as gender today is really a layering of stories that really assigns human beings certain roles and functions and expectations that become conditioned and wired into our own nervous system, you know, with those three vectors of culture. And now there isn't any good or bad around it. If someone wants to prescribe to those functions and roles, that's beautiful. That's the way they want to live. But it becomes a hierarchy when they are boxed into those roles and functions without any alternatives. And that's kind of the root cause of the suffering that bias causes, but also the inequity and, you know, the harms of bias itself.
You break bias into four categories outside of the unconscious and conscious. It's internalized, interpersonal, institutionalized, and systemic. Tell me about those categories.
So as I shared, like, biases are just learned. And for me, like, what happened to me as a young person growing up in the U.S. of, you know, facing discrimination because of my race or sexuality or immigrant status, I believed them, right? Those stories. And then those stories became internalized. And as a result, they manifested in the way I treated myself, that negative self-talk that I constantly had. The way I would behave, I changed my name to Andy for a number of years, for example. The way I would walk, I didn't want to be perceived as feminine. The way I would move my hands, the inflections in my tone. If my voice ever got to be high-pitched, I would get really ashamed because of the associations, you know, with femininity. And then what would that mean around people's perceptions of me? all of these, you know, really prevented me from living and being my authentic self. And that's really internalized bias. So that's really when we, you know, perceive ourselves from that lens of stereotypes. And then there's interpersonal bias, when those stories really impact the way we perceive others, and then of course make decisions toward others. So this is of course important in a familial situation, in a community situation, but also with strangers. And this is what we're seeing a lot of challenges around, you know, inequities based on race or gender or sexuality or age, because people's perceptions are really rooted in those five causes. So it comes off in the doctor's office, in the classroom with the teacher, and most prominently with police officers, right? We've seen so much of that. Like, what's happening in people's nervous systems when they see a human with dark skin or with long hair or wearing glasses or, you know, that are houseless? And that's kind of the root of the interpersonal bias. But now these interpersonal biases, let's say the disparities in care that doctors give or nurses give to patients of color, for example, those micro decisions then become institutionalized and aggregate into kind of an institution-wide disparities that then become systemic. So institutions are actually made up of people like you and I, and institutionalized biases are basically distortions. So that's kind of how something that starts within ourself, right, becomes aggregated into a systems level problem. And that's what we're facing, not just in our country, but around the world.
I want to talk about this bias breaking tool that you call PRISM. But before we get to that, let's talk about the Bradley effect. This tendency happens when individuals inaccurately report their true beliefs to make themselves look better, to present themselves in the best possible light. Tell me about Tom Bradley.
Yeah, so basically Tom Bradley was a widely popular mayor of Los Angeles in the late 70s, early 80s. And then he decided to run for the governor of California. And for weeks leading up to the election, all the polls everywhere, all the posters were saying that, oh, he's going to win. He's going to be the first Black governor of California. Everybody was really excited. Except on election day, he lost. And folks were just really confused. And that's where, you know, social scientists began to really identify this phenomenon, what they named after him, called the Bradley effect. But it's really social desirability bias. You know, it kind of captures this like really unhelpful human tendency that we all have to say one thing but do another. You know, often in direct opposition to what we say, because we want to be perceived as likable. And this, of course, comes up not just around race, but also gender, right? This is what happened in 2016, where Hillary Clinton was certainly the favorite, but she lost. Now, what's really important for people to understand is why social desirability bias happens.
And you've named a three-step neurological process of social desirability bias occurring, right?
Yeah, the process of any form of bias that triggers in us has three nodes: contact, trigger, and then reaction or response. So what that means really is our senses, you know, our sense of sight, our sense of hearing, you know, smell, all these senses, they contact the identities of a person, their race, their gender, their profession, all sorts of things. And then that triggers, that contact with our senses triggers the stored associations we have had with those identities. And then we have a choice. We either react from what we've learned based on what we know in the past, or we become aware of those reactions and then respond differently. And I think for me, the third node is really where we can find freedom from bias.
The Bradley effect is especially relevant right now, as Kamala Harris is both a person of color and a woman. And this may have been part of why Democrats and Republicans who opposed Trump and everyone in between had been pushing to keep Joe Biden in the race despite numerous concerns.
Absolutely. That was it, because for all Americans and people around the world, their only conception of a president has been a male figure, right? And generally a white male figure.
And an old male figure.
All sorts of other intersectional identities. So I think that was what was happening for them. And it was like a fear-based response. because to go for someone who doesn't hold those identities is quite risky. And they had seen what had happened in 2016.
Anu, we have these internal biases and they're everywhere. In terms of the Bradley effect, why are we so inclined to pretend they're not as opposed to facing them directly? Like, why are we inclined to self-report in a way that's different than what our actions will be instead of addressing that desire and that difference?
Probably one of the most important questions around this topic of bias itself. And this is what I've spent 10 years studying. When I first started my work, I really wanted to make sure that this work of breaking bias was backed by science, was backed by neuroscience. And, you know, we reached out to the National Science Foundation, who helped us really understand and funded some of our research. And basically what I discovered is that the reason why we are unable to face it directly, when, you know, you and I are talking, we're like, oh yeah, this is common sense, is because there's a lot of afflictive emotions attached to this idea. Shame, blame, guilt. So this is, for me, as someone who works in this field, this is one of the reasons why there's been such massive backlash around issues of diversity and inclusion and equity. And for me, it's like, oh, we have to address this, because shame is like an afflictive emotion that gets people's defenses up. You know, it triggers in our nervous system a fight-flight response. And what it's really saying for a lot of people when they think about bias, they're like, oh my God, I'm not biased. I'm a good person, which they are, right? But bias isn't personal. It's something that's been wired into us. It's been programmed into us. So for us, for me, it's really important then to really address this issue with what scientists say to work. If there's shame or blame or guilt in the conversation, we lean into empathy, compassion, joy, vulnerability, and really build psychologically safe containers to help people rid themselves of biases.
And you suggest that this bias breaking tool, you call it PRISM, can help solve this even in as little as 3 weeks.
21 days.
Tell me about PRISM.
One of the things that's been really promising is there's a neuropsychologist in the 1950s named Donald Hebb. And he talks about, you know, any habit that we have is really a product of practice. So if we think about learning how to cook or learning how to drive, it was through practice. We didn't just sit behind a steering wheel and start, you know, driving. Over time, we built the motor reflexes. So very similarly, that's how we learn biases, you know, from our surroundings, from those five causes. But we can also unlearn them with these five other causes. And that's kind of the joy and promise of this idea known as neuroplasticity, our ability to rewire our brains. And PRISM basically is an acronym for five of those tools, each of which have been shown by scientists to measurably reduce bias. Conscious and unconscious. And it really stands for perspective taking, R for prosocial behavior, I for individuation, S for stereotype replacement, and M for mindfulness. And we really begin the practice of PRISM with mindfulness and then work our way back up to perspective taking. And the way this would work is really first really noticing as stereotypes arise. You know, if someone is with me, you know, I look Indian, I talk a certain way, they may have certain associations based on my various identities, and that's okay, but become mindful of those stereotypes or those associations and not use those associations to make decisions. That's the promise of mindfulness. Then we move to stereotype replacement. When we notice negative associations, we replace them with positive counterexamples. So for example, for Kamala Harris, because the way many of us have been trained around various stereotypes about her various identities, we think of people that don't live up to those stereotypes at all and really replace them. Ella Baker, Maya Angelou, all these other women, right? So as a result, we're weakening that association. Neurons that fire together, wire together. Moving to individuation, which is really a dissociating group-based association from the individual. And then we move to kind of hard practices of prosocial behaviors, which are active cultivation of compassion and empathy. And a lot of research has been done around prosocial behaviors at the Stanford Medical School to show the transformative nature of how this reduces bias. Because what it does is it allows us to change the negative affect associated with, you know, stereotypes. And the way we do that is really repeating positive affirmations like, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe. So in a society where oftentimes we're confronting so much negativity our mind directly goes to everything that can go wrong. But this, you know, basically directing our attention toward the positive really helps us weaken that negativity. And then ultimately perspective taking, which is really a visualization practice of imagining what it's like to be in other people's shoes. So we basically practice PRISM to build new habits on a regular or daily basis. And 3 weeks is how long it takes for us to build a new habit. So I would say anywhere from like 10 to 15 minutes daily, if we practice PRISM, we can really begin to unlearn biases and then replace them, you know, with more wholesome ways of being.
You talk a lot about mindfulness throughout Breaking Bias and about applying ourselves specifically using I statements, being present throughout reading the book. And you have little breaks throughout the book that are mindfulness checkpoints almost, where you ask questions for the reader to self-reflect. How is self-reflection key to this journey?
Yeah, I think Breaking Bias is a journey of self-reflection, because what we're doing is, as Carl Jung said, making the unconscious conscious. And the best way to make the unconscious conscious is by noticing what's in the unconscious. What are the fears? You know, what are the associations, the concepts, and also what are the emotions? For me, this conversation, this phenomenon of bias, we often think it's very logical. But, you know, I realized pretty quickly after working in the law that if this was rational, we would have solved it by now, because there are libraries upon libraries, you know, identifying the causes of bias and how it operates. And yet we are where we are. And that's because bias is also emotional. And I think that's where mindfulness is really helpful, because oftentimes with bias, we feel, you know, a lot of discomfort. But what mindfulness helps us do is really become, like, observe that discomfort, become aware of that discomfort, not just in the mind, but also somatically in our bodies. We begin to notice what's beneath our fears, what's beneath the discomfort. And oftentimes it's personal and it's painful, like something that we have been, may have experienced within a workplace or within our schools or within our families that we have yet to confront. And then mindfulness and the five PRISM tools really help us really bring that to awareness and begin to release it, so we can come back to the present and really then again unleash our own potential as human beings, but also invite others to do the same.
Let's take a couple of steps back and look at biases as a whole. You've experienced discrimination for much of your life, which is what eventually led you to the study of bias. And it's shocking how prevalent bias still is in our modern society. And how do you stay positive when spending so much time discussing this discrimination and these inherent biases?
It's such a wonderful question. One of the things that I've been really blessed with is just having insight, you know, hindsight of history, and just noticing how far we've come. You know, of course, we have so much farther to go. But when I think about 50 years ago, 100 years ago, things were very different for me, my ancestors, for you, for your ancestors, for all of us. And so much change has taken place in that time. So I feel like that's what progress is about. That's what this movement towards freedom and liberation is. And, you know, I'm always inspired by Dr. King's vision. There's two things he said, which is, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And simultaneously, he also painted a vision for us, which is our goal is to build a beloved community. This will require qualitative changes in our souls and quantitative changes in our lives. And for me, he really created the blueprint of what we need to do to build a society where all of us feel a sense of belonging in the fullness of our humanity, in the fullness of our diversity. And that requires those qualitative and quantitative changes, which is where bias really comes in. And for me, that's where I stay hopeful that this is our work to do in this century. So we can move beyond, you know, just the splintering of our humanity based on various identities, to the really acknowledge the fullness of who we are as human beings across our gender, our sexuality, our color, our race, our ethnicity, our religion, because there's just one Earth.
That's Anu Gupta, Anu Gupta is a lawyer, a scientist, and an educator focused on combining neuroscience, psychology, and research to find the causes of and solutions to organizational diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. And his most recent book is Breaking Bias. Anu Gupta, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio, and if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us then, you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our executive producer is Matthew LaPlante. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot, and I'm Reagan Edelman. Thank you for listening. Now go have big ideas.